Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Welcome to Minnesota. I just got back from a very warm place, and it was, let's see, what's the difference in temperature in 12 hours? 40 degrees? No. Was it 80? Jeez. 90 degrees difference in temperature? What, something like that. So, Happy New Year! Happy New Year! Some people are still into saying that. Other people just look at me when I say that. New Year's, sometimes we make resolutions. Sometimes we don't make resolutions. Some of us are into that kind of thing, and some of us aren't into it. It's not been my thing generally to make New Year's resolutions. But when we make a resolution to do something, if we're going to do it, it really has to come out of aspiration, because if we just resolve that we're going to eat less food, that's a good one for me at least. We really resolve that. We have to have some aspiration to, if our resolution is based on the fact that we're a little overweight, then we have to have an aspiration. We have to actually be able to imagine ourselves eating less and feeling good. And the more we can imagine ourselves eating less and feeling good and looking sexy or whatever. Although I'm 70, so I'm not supposed to be interested in looking sexy anymore. But I'm more interested in ever looking sexy. Whatever's left, I'll take it. I'll take it. So, and if there's not aspiration underneath our resolution, generally it doesn't work. So, and you guys know where I'm going with this. Those of you who listened to me before. So, when I was when I began practicing Zen practice as a young man, I developed an aspiration, and it was kind of an unrealistic aspiration. At least that's what my friends said, what my family said. And my aspiration was that I would, by practicing Zen, let go of all of this mental baggage that I was carrying around, and that I would become as light as this Japanese midget that I'd met was. His name Suzuki. And I only say a midget. He was a midget because he was under... He was under 5 feet, and the only person that I knew that was under 5 feet was a midget. And he carried himself so lightly. He seemed to be able just to let go of stuff and just be where he was. So my aspiration was to do whatever necessary to enter that world, to be like that. And I was in a fraternity how could I have been in a fraternity, but I was. I was in a fraternity, and I remember those guys saying, he's gone off the edge. And it was before the counterculture, so I didn't really have anybody to do this with. But that's okay. Good morning. Got your coffee, huh? I hope it's warm. So before that, I had an aspiration to be a doctor or a lawyer, because everybody in my family, all the men, were doctors or lawyers. Doctors or lawyers, or lawyers or doctors, or doctors, that's what they all were. But that aspiration did not appeal to me. It was a dry aspiration based on what my culture told me. And plus, they all seemed anxious and trying to beat each other up and out. And so, well, I developed this aspiration. And it continues to be my aspiration. It's my aspiration to live lightly and joyfully with you guys, with all of us together. And take care of before and after, but let go of before and after. Let go of them so we can take care of them. So I think that aspiration has two important components. One is imagination and the other is courage. So I actually had to imagine myself letting go of all this worry that I carried around, all this anxiety. And I didn't have any role models except this one little midget. Or big midget or something. But that was good enough. That was good enough. Viktor Frankl, in his book Search for Meaning, talks about concentration camps, right? World War II concentration camps. Some of you read his book, Man's Search for Meaning. I haven't read it for years. For years. But the people who came out of it okay, those who lived, the difference between those who lived and came out of it okay and those who didn't come out of it okay had to do with imagining another life, imagining a life where they did something meaningful, something purposeful, something they really cared about. And those are the ones who 20 years after the Holocaust, we're doing great. So imagine it. There can't be aspiration without imagining. Without imagining that you can actually do what you aspire to do. You can. And you will. And you will. As many of you know, I've worked with homeless folks a lot, although these days I don't really work with them. I just support them. But homelessness, bringing homeless people inside, people who, first time we started bringing homeless people inside, my agency, the biggest issue for them was that they lost their sense of purpose once they were inside. It wasn't there. We thought, oh God, we'll bring them inside, you know, and their chemical dependency will ravage them, and you know they'll be sneaking booze in, and they'll be, you know, wanting to toke up, and they'll be, you know, their mental illness will be out of control. Well, we dealt with those things, but mostly we dealt with, all of a sudden they didn't have a purpose. Their purpose was to get a meal, to stay warm. To make it through the next 5 hours. When they lost their purpose, when they lost their aspiration, they want to go back outside. Weird, huh? Weird. But that's the way we are as human beings. We need aspiration. We need purpose. We need meaning. So we would try to teach them, you know. Well, you know, you can develop some other aspirations now. Beyond worrying about the next meal, what about what you might do tomorrow? Can you imagine yourself doing something tomorrow with plenty of food and plenty of sleep? Or maybe next week? Gradually replacing all of their just instinctual drive to stay alive aspiration with something imaginative. So our imaginations are very rich, and we can all do this. We don't have to be tied to the past. Well, we can be tied to the past, but we don't have to be tied to our past negativity. And of course, this takes courage to aspire to something that. And then to imagine it, and then to actually do it, to actually take on the practice. When I began this practice, it wasn't only that I imagined it, it is that I had to be courageous. I had to be courageous enough to say no to my dad and my university. I mean, I didn't. That was a little extreme. I could have stayed in college, but when your aspiration is big, sometimes you extreme. Go with your aspiration. Be extreme. I mean, really, go with it. Go with it. If you have an aspiration. Again, it was before the counterculture. If I'd done this 5 years later, I would have had a bunch of people to do it with, and it wouldn't have taken much courage. But when I started doing this so many years ago, many of you were not born, and nobody else was doing it. So I had to really courageously say, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm doing. And those Jews in the concentration camp, what about them? Didn't it take a lot of courage for them to imagine? I mean, here the incinerators were all around. They smelled the burning flesh, right? They saw what was happening, but they had the courage to imagine another life, to imagine doing something afterwards, something meaningful, something loving, something that came from their hearts. Takes courage. Imagination and courage can evoke aspiration and sustain aspiration in any circumstance, in any circumstance. And when we brought these homeless folks in, when it's cold like today, I thought, geez, I think about it. What did they call it when they're out there panhandling? They call it flying a sign. I wonder how many people are out there flying a sign today. I doubt very many. But anyway, we bring homeless people in, and then help them imagine themselves a month from now, maybe in their own place, maybe doing volunteer work. Maybe even getting a job that they like or re-entering society, but don't push them because it's got to come from them. But it takes courage because most homeless people live within a trance of inadequacy, a trance of defectiveness. But how many people who are not homeless, how many of you guys live within a trance of defectiveness, a trance of inadequacy? Takes courage, doesn't it, to go beyond that trance, to take a step out of that trance, to imagine yourself moving to something you really aspire to. And of course in Zen, we can talk about aspiration in different ways, but this morning I'm talking about aspiration, that our aspiration, my aspiration as a Zen practitioner, is to be wholeheartedly engaged in everything. To be wholeheartedly engaged in each activity. Simple Zen, very simple, right? Shikan. Just to be engaged in whatever the activity is, all the activities that we engage in. And so, one of my stories, which I've not read for a while, from Magic Tales of the Magic Monastery, I knew there were many interesting sites, but I didn't want any more of the little answers. I wanted the big answer. So I asked the guest master to show me the house of the Christian God. I sat myself down, quite willing to wait for the big answer. I remained silent all day, far into the night. I looked him in the eye. I guess he was looking me in the eye. Late at night, I seemed to hear a voice. What are you leaving out? I looked around. I heard it again. What are you leaving out? Was it my imagination? Soon it was all around me, whispering, roaring. What are you leaving out? What are you leaving out? Was I cracking up? I managed to get to my feet and head for the door. I guess I wanted the comfort of a human face or a human voice. Nearby was the corridor where some of the monks live. I knocked on one cell. "What do you want?" came a sleepy voice. "What am I leaving out?" "Me," he answered. I went to the next door. "What do you want?" "What am I leaving out?" "Me." A third cell. All the same. I thought to myself, they're all stuck on themselves. I left the building in disgust. Just then the sun was coming up. I had never spoken to the sun before, but I heard myself pleading, "What am I leaving out?" The sun, too, answered, "Me." That finished me. I threw myself flat on the ground. Then the earth said, "Me too." Wholehearted engagement. Simple. Cliche. Nothing to it. And yet it's my whole life. It's my whole life. Do I fail? Sure, I fail. Sure. But I wholeheartedly engage again. Up and down, up and down. In and out, in and out. So when I developed my aspiration as a young man to do Zen practice and make it the center of my life, so that I could become light the way my teacher was light, able to be resilient the way my teacher was resilient. I then focused on meditation, because this is what it's all about, right? Meditation. Zazen, we call it, right? Zazen. Began doing a lot of meditation. Dropped out of school, you know, lived across the street from the Zen. Sat in the morning, sat at night, sat in retreats, meditation. And, is this not working? Is that
sound?
Oh. Do we need to take a pause here? I don't know. We'll take a pause, totally engage in breathing. How about that? Let's do that. That would be novel. Okay, so committed myself to meditation as part of my aspiration, and my teacher wanted to open have a little meditation center down in my hometown when I went back to college, and so we did that, and I found a student's house for us to sit in. And we did it once a week. This is a graduate student's house at Stanford University. And so my teacher would come down. This is Suzuki Roshi. He'd come down in the morning, and then we'd do our sitting. And then after our sitting, he'd have us clean the whole place, the whole downstairs. Which I didn't appreciate. Number one, I didn't appreciate it because I had classes to go to. And second, these graduate students who let us use their house, they were slobs. And they just slept upstairs while we were meditating. And then he wanted to clean the whole place. But, you know, I did it a few times with him. And then finally I said to him, you know, Sensei, we have to go to classes. You know, we're Stanford students. I didn't say that, but we have to go to classes. And he said, okay, then we'll have to start earlier. Well, we're already starting at 5:40, which is only about 2 hours after I went to bed. And we'll have to start earlier. Wholehearted engagement includes everything. Manual labor is a great part of our practice. It's pretty easy to engage in manual labor if you give yourself to it. It's a good meditative practice. Plus, you make something beautiful. You make something clean and beautiful. Broad aspiration in Zen, total engagement in whatever activity we're doing. Broad aspiration. So that's our aspiration. My aspiration. I don't want to lay this on you. My aspiration. Okay. Possibly your aspiration. That would be nice. That would be nice. And what are the hindrances to doing this once we commit ourselves and work on it? Well, one is, I think, there's a fear of interrupting our narrative by merging. One of the reasons I didn't like to do physical labor in the morning is that I'd be getting ready to go to my classes. So I'd have to be thinking about, well, what do I have to do to prepare? What's going to the subject matter? Did I do the homework correctly? I wanted to prepare, and we don't want to have our narrative messed with. But if we totally engage, we have to let go of our narrative, completely let go of it, and it'll come back. We're afraid that if we let go of our narrative, it won't come back. We'll lose who we are, but it comes back. It comes back. So we are afraid of that, and we're afraid of intimacy. We're afraid of being intimate with a broom, for instance. Just a broom, so that the broom does the sweeping with us. Who's sweeping? The broom sweeping? Me sweeping? The room sweeping? We don't know. We're intimate with it, but we're afraid of that because somehow, I don't know, it interferes with our internal talking, which is so addictive. So addictive. And we're afraid of intimacy with others, too. So when my friend Patrick would take me to the homeless camps years ago, I wasn't sure if I'd want to go. And I'd sort of have to prepare myself. What was I going to say? How I was going to act? What if somebody was really stoned or really did something weird? But Patrick just went in. He just went in, and he taught me just to go, just to be humble, just to be not humble in a fake way, but just to go and be there with the people who are there. Pay attention, totally engage. If they offer me cold coffee, take the cold coffee. Maybe I only have to drink a little sip of it, but take it. Totally engage. If they're not interested in something, maybe I'm interested in them getting out of the cold. but they don't want to get out of the coal. They're interested in having a, that they have a hangnail, and help them with a hangnail. Just totally soak in. This is what wholehearted Zen is, totally soaking in to whatever experience we're with. Very, very simple. And instead of saying, oh, you know, those people have cooties. You know, I don't want to go to the hang out with those people, those rich people, those homeless people, those legislators, those fundamentalists. They have cooties. We've all got cooties. We've all got the same cooties. It's the human situation. So fear of merging. We think we want to merge, but actually we don't. We don't. And second is belief. We get stuck on our beliefs, so we can't fully engage. We can't fully engage. These folks who fly the signs and these homeless folks, they're hopelessly chemically dependent. There's no point in engaging with them, or they're manipulative or something. Meditation is better than manual labor. It's higher. It's more noble. Well, this is about total engagement. This is not about a hierarchy of what's best. We're caught in a hierarchy of what's best and worst. So this is about total engagement, not this is better than the other. Temporarily, something may be better than something else, but only temporarily, only expediently, only practically, not in terms of our aspiration to be totally engaged in what is. So Umon, Zen Master Umon, was asked, what is the teaching of Buddha's lifetime? He said, teaching facing oneness. Wholehearted engagement, in other words. Teaching facing oneness. And Suzuki Roshi said, when you do something without any thought of doing something, that is you yourself. When you do something without any thought of doing something, that is you yourself. Sometimes we do that. Sometimes we're just naturally available. But as a practice, this becomes not just an occasional occurrence, but we settle into it so it becomes our natural way of being. But we can only do that little by little with great patience and with deep aspiration. So there are three veils traditionally in Zen meditation that sort of prevent us from actualizing our aspiration, that prevent us from being intimate with a broom or another person or our hands in the dishwater, not in the dishwasher, but in the dishwater. Oh, I could be intimate with my hands in the dishwasher. Those three types of veils are the body veils, heart veils, and the mind veils. Body veils. So we store a lot of stuff in our bodies, don't we? We store a lot of stuff in our bodies, and we contract around that stuff that we store in our bodies. And one reason sitting retreats is kind of hard is that we experience that retraction in a retreat, especially for any long sitting. I was working with a guy a few years ago who, when he would sit in retreats, he would get tension, real tension in his throat area, and almost like he'd get a great big lump in his throat. And after sitting for, you know, long sits, he'd almost have a gag reflex going. Well, he just stayed with that. He just stayed with that with my encouragement. I mean, I didn't know. I don't know. But I encourage him to do what we all do, is stay with the contraction. Stay with it. Breathe into it. Be kind to it. And what came up for him was something when he was 3 years old. When he was 3 years old and lived in California, when he was in his high chair every morning, his mother gave him soft-boiled eggs. This is actually true. This is his mother gave him soft-boiled eggs, and he was expected to sit in his high chair until he ate all the soft-boiled egg. And a couple of times he said he even vomited this. This sounds kind of gross, but this is what he said. He even vomited the soft-boiled egg, and he still had to he had to eat it. Or, well, anyway. So here he is. The guy's 50 years old, right? He's 50 years old. He's sitting here in the zendo, and he's got this tightness in his throat, and it all comes back. It all comes back. That emotional memory that's lodged there in his throat comes back, and he's able to see it, to breathe into it, to let go of it, and gradually it abates and doesn't come back anymore. And that's kind of the process that we go through in meditation when we feel contractions in our body. That sounds like therapy, but it doesn't have to. I mean, we do it. We don't do it to try to get anywhere. We just see what happens, see what comes up. And sometimes nothing comes up. Sometimes you just have pain in your shoulders and there's nothing there. But then that's just pain in your shoulders. You're contracting around that pain. You're not opening to that pain. And it's possible to open in that train to that pain and really trust the process of not self-consciously trying to manipulate the pain, trying to get out of it. Suzuki Roshi said, the only thing to do about pain is to let it be painful. Well, that's right. That's right. And of course, sitting is especially important in the 21st century. I mean, meditative sitting. And we find more people interested in meditative sitting, certainly than 10 years ago. But we also find that people have a harder time doing meditation sitting than they did 10 years ago. You know what it's like. You guys know what it's like. You're younger than me. You know what it's like with texting, twittering, and tweeting, and all that stuff. And when I have meetings at my other place, we make people leave their iPhones outside the meeting room because we can't trust them. They can't trust themselves. They got to text and tweet and Twitter. Well, so we need since we are so hyperactive as a culture and as a people and as individuals, we need meditation. We need it. We need an aspiration to settle down into our original quietness. Not be concerned about tweeting and texting and all that stuff. So that's veils over the body. And then we have veils over the heart. Veils over the heart. So many men that I've worked with over the years, anger is their big veil. But then under that veil, what's another veil? Oh. They see the anger, and then under that, maybe self-doubt. Maybe sadness. And under that veil, another veil. These veils fall away, and we become closer to what is. We become able to engage more with just what is. Easily. Easily. Not as a big project. And then we have the mind veil. Suzuki Roshi says, there are limits to the pain the body can endure, but no limits to mental pain. Well, you guys know that, right? Mental pain is limitless. The mind veils are limitless. We cover over our emotion. We cover over our physical pain. We sometimes so spaced out, we don't even know we're sitting on the cushion. The bell rings, and we thought, oh, that went... that. 30 minutes went by fast because we were so spaced out, right? And of course, this is all about the inner critic, which we get to know very intimately. Those of us who do meditation, we get to know the inner critic very intimately. And the inner critic can also be called the internal parent. And we need an internal parent. I was just with my grandsons, my 8-year-old grandson and my 4-year-old grandson, for 3.5 weeks, which was really fun. And my 4-year-old grandson, his mantra for the 3.5 weeks was, "Not my fault. Not my fault, Grandpa. Not my fault, Mama. Not my fault, not my fault. Enough, 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 Logan." Enough, enough, enough. Well, then about 3 or 4 days ago, this is about 5 or 6 days ago, I heard a huge crash in the bathroom. A huge crash. And my daughter Erin ran into the bathroom, and then I ran in and looked at, and the top to the toilet tank was in pieces, disintegrated on the bathroom floor. And Logan ran out yelling. And then Logan got calmed down, and I said, Logan seemed, he was really, upset. So I said, not your fault, Logan, not your fault. And he said, "My fault, Grandpa." My fault. And I said to Erin, "Why does he say it's his fault?" She said he was using it as a jungle gym. He was on top of the tank, jumping up and down. It sure was his fault. So he's beginning to internalize he's internalizing the parenting his parents have done. He's saying, "This is my fault. I did this. Finally, this is my fault." So we need that internal parent, don't we? But something happens along the way that internal parent turns into a harsh, unyielding internal critic that takes everything over and that kind of ruins most people's lives. Unless you're a sociopath or a psychopath, then you've never developed the internal parent. You've never done that. You need it. You need it. Then it's always not my fault. So in Zen practice, is about coming back into balance and seeing when the internal parent is just overdoing things, which is about, I always make up these percentages, right? About 89 to 93. 4% of the time. And so in our sitting, this becomes our koan, our natural dilemma is to be as much as possible be peaceful and kind to this, all these internal chaos that's coming up, all this judging about, all this comparing, all this, and just breathe into it and let those mind veils go. They're just gossamer. They don't amount to anything. They're just thoughts. They're so light. They seem heavy, but they're just thoughts. All those veils. So we begin through this process, through our great aspiration of seeing those veils and noticing their gossamer and just letting them fall away. The mind veils, the heart veils, the body veils. Letting them fall away. And we can become quite good at that. And then we're able to wholeheartedly engage in whatever. It becomes quite natural to wholeheartedly engage in whatever. But this is a practice that takes imagination and courage. So I'll tell us one last story. Which I think I probably told in the retreat, and I have told probably about 10 times before. But this is over a period of 11 years, So my teacher, actually I did tell this in Rahatsu, so I just told the story, but that's okay. It doesn't hurt to hear it again. My teacher was asked to speak at, this is an hour way back to when I'm a young man again, right? I was asked to speak at Stanford University where I went to school. And he was not too happy about this. I don't know why he just didn't turn it down. Probably his ego or something, I don't know. But he was asked to speak, so he said, yeah, he'd speak. I think he was intimidated. His English was not good, and I think he was intimidated. I don't know. Anyway, because even teachers get intimidated, you guys. He came down to speak. I was there. I was sitting next to him. I didn't bring him down to speak, down from San Francisco. San Francisco, Palo Alto, those of you who know the West Coast. I live in Palo Alto. He was in San Francisco. So I'm sitting next to him in the auditorium, wherever we're having it. And it's just before he's supposed to speak. And he looks at me and he says, I'm scared. And he squeezes my hand. I mean, in a not too hard, but you know, like a little, like my grandson when I squeeze my hand. I think he squeezes my hand. He said, "I'm scared." And then the guy introduces. He gets up. He gives a wonderful talk. Wonderful, just totally available, totally engaged. 1 minute, "I'm scared." The next minute, wonderful talk. So we can develop this resiliency, this openness to see the veils, to be with them, to let them part, and make ourselves available to whatever. Seeing is releasing. Seeing is he saw the fear. I'm scared, completely scared, and then he let it go, got up and spoke, right? Total engagement. Right? Total engagement. No idea of trying to be totally engaged. No. There we get all mixed up. Just doing it. So I want to finish with a poem from Dogen, the founder of our Zen school. This is a poem from the last year of his life. He died at 54. 4 and 50 years I've hung the sky with stars. Now I leap through. What's shattering? 4 and 50 years I've hung the sky with stars. Now I leap through. What's shattering? So lines 1 and 2. 4 and 50 years I've hung the sky with stars. So this is his aspiration. This is his aspiration, which Dogen himself develops as a young man. This is his poetic expression of aspiration. To hang the sky with stars. Because as a young man, he did Zen practice, and he didn't feel that... he became actually a transmitted Zen teacher, able to teach, but he still didn't feel like he was able to totally engage in life, in the world. And he had an aspiration, an imagination that he could do that, that even though there weren't many good Zen teachers in Japan or Zen teachers who had really opened themselves up and really parted their veils, that he could find a teacher who had done that and do this himself. So he went to China, very difficult voyage to China. In those days, it was a considered treacherous voyage to take a boat from Japan to China. You look at it on the map now, it's hard to believe, but treacherous. And then in China, he kept his aspiration alive. He kept his imagination, his sense that there were people who could help him lighten up, let go of his veils, let go of his heart veil, his mind veil, his body veil. And then he found a teacher in his last year, just before he was getting to go home, getting ready to go home to Japan, because in China, he said, oh, most of the Buddhists are just trying to appease the gods, like they were in Japan. You think there's no God in Buddhism? Well, get into a lot of the details of devotional Buddhism. There are gods all over the place. All over the place. But finally, he found a teacher who seemed light, who seemed open, and practiced with him wholeheartedly. And then he went back and had a real awakening, and went back to Japan, and nobody was very interested in doing what he wanted to do. But he went out and set up a Zen center out in the country, and if some people came, and of course it became the founding of the Soto Zen school. But he didn't know that. He didn't know that, and he was just following his aspiration. That's all he was doing. And it really wasn't until 150 years ago. This is in 1230, roughly. 1230. It wasn't until 150 years ago that he became a big deal. He's a big deal now in Japan. And he has been since 1850. For 600 years. Yeah, the Soto school was there, but Dogen was not a big deal. Only been 150 years. But he had the aspiration. He did it. He did it. And he had the courage. He had the courage. And so, 450 years, I've hung the sky with stars. Now I leap through what's shattering. So through his aspiration, he had the courage to continue this practice until he was able to shatter all of these divisions, all of these feelings of separation that we do through veiling ourselves off, through not being intimate, through not being engaged. And so he was even able to let go of the dichotomy between life and death. You can let go of that dichotomy through this practice. It's just another dichotomy. By being totally engaged. Then when life comes, you live, and when death comes, you die. And the more you learn to die, the more you'll be able to learn to live. That's true. The more you learn to die to the past, to die to your worries, to die all that stuff that's built up, the more you can come to life. Just here. Just being engaged with this, even not knowing what it is. What it is at all. Just being engaged. And forgetting to even be engaged. Okay. Probably about 5 minutes. Does anybody has any questions or comments? Questions, comments?
Scared of the downstairs of our old house, our first house, and just absolutely frightened of whatever was down there. Nothing ever was down there. The other night I just had the exact same. I don't know what going forward that entails.
Yes, well. It entails just paying attention to it, just being with it gently. And it doesn't entail anything. We always want to know what something entails. It entails just being with it, just noticing it and appreciating it and letting it show itself and being grateful that it's passing through. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
To get an experience like that and then pay attention to it, and if you could say something about, in my experience, if you can pay attention to it in a way that is unhelpful.
Well, of course, it is unhelpful if we start. Did you guys hear what she said? Do you want to say it a little louder, or should I say it? You said it.
So, just what Steve was saying, and then the things that to pay attention to it, and in my experience, there's a way that you can pay attention to it that's unhelpful.
So say more about how it's unhelpful to pay attention to it.
So wanting to fix it or understand it, or
yes, but fixing and understanding is not what I'm talking about. That's not paying attention to it. That's not really opening your heart to it and being with it. Fixing it and understanding it is not what I'm talking about. Does that make sense to you? But there are times when the pain, the psychic pain, is too great even to pay attention to it. Then we should do our shamatha meditation, our concentration meditation. This guy had this thing about the 3-year-old high chair. It's hard to imagine that. That's maybe not a good example, but there. Sometimes I teach these two different ways of meditation that come out of our tradition. The one is bare awareness, which I'm talking about. But sometimes we need to do just concentration meditation, where we just watch our breathing or count our breathing or repeat something to ourselves because the pain is too strong. Or the need to understand is too persistently aggravating. Then we do concentration meditation. So we go back and forth between bare awareness and concentration meditation. How is that? Yeah, Karen.
It's a different topic. So we've worked with the homeless for so long, and taught us the 70s. Maybe you could tell us if it's always been, if this country always has been such inequity.
Always such inequity?
Yeah. In your lifetime.
Between economic inequity,
yeah.
Social inequity? Oh, jeez.
I'm not asking you to be an expert. I'm just asking you.
Yeah. Well, this has not been a good time for us in this country. We should not be proud of the last 10 years. I don't know if that's what you're talking about. We should not be proud. Well, you know that there's just more differentiation between the haves and the have-nots than there was 10 years ago. So we should not be proud of that. But I don't know if that's what you're asking about.
Yeah, I was thinking a little farther back, but.
I don't know. Yeah, it's an interesting thing about homelessness, and I don't think I only have five more. I'm supposed to quit right now, actually. Interesting thing about homelessness is that during the last, I know you're thinking about long term, but I'm thinking about shorter term. Within the last 15 years, there's been more acknowledgement of homelessness as being a social problem, and more attempt to develop shelters and help people. Really, a huge improvement in 16 years in our consciousness about homelessness, and yet there are more homeless people than there were 16 years ago. So, what's the deal there? What's the deal there? There's more. Something's not okay. Not okay. Yeah. But I think I have to. Yeah, Robert.
I just want to, I can answer your question from my perspective.
Oh, okay, sure, Robert.
I noticed when Reagan was president that the numbers of limousines and the number of homeless people started increasing more and more and more. And it's been more and more and more ever since then.
That's right, and of course, what Reagan did was, he was governor of my home state, California. One of the first things he did when he was governor of my home state is he to save money, he closed the regional treatment centers, the hospitals for mentally ill, and added to the homeless population by thousands and thousands and thousands of people, because it wasn't, sure, it's fine to close them, but there were no alternatives. So in San Jose, which is, again, near where I grew up, there a ghetto developed of homeless people just during Reagan's term. I think there were 50,000 homeless people, 100,000 homeless people during his term living in San Jose, all of whom were mentally ill. But anyway, that's a whole different conversation. And what I'm saying to you guys is, find your heart aspiration, and sing to it. Sing to your heart aspiration, and it will take you where you want to go. It will take you where you want to go. It's just the way it is. Well, thank you.